Could I have your attention, please? My name's Lawrence Cram. I'm the Deputy Vice-Chancellor of ANU, and it's a great pleasure to be here this evening. I'd like to commence the evening's proceedings by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which the ANU is built. I acknowledge the country that we're meeting on, the lands of the Ngunnawal people, the traditional owners. We respect their continuing culture and the unique contribution that they make to the life of this area. It's a great pleasure to be here introducing the speaker who is going to talk about the subject of uncertainty and risk related to the launch of the book Uncertainty and Risk, Multidisciplinary Perspectives, that's been edited by Gabriel Bammer and Michael Smithson. I can remember being part of the gestation of the book. I think Gabriel may have come and discussed it with me even before the rather wonderful seminar at the Coolabri Resort. And I've just reminded her, because she didn't listen, of the envy that I felt about the fact that I couldn't participate in that rather wonderful discussion of people, many of whom I knew, about a topic that I really quite have a great deal of affection for. I'd just come off the pleasure of lecturing to senior physics students at another university in a subject that I quite like, quantum mechanics. And, of course, quantum mechanics and uncertainty go hand in glove. And it was always a challenge, to get two different ideas across to some of the brightest science students outside the science students at the ANU, who are even brighter. The idea that the world isn't the way we see it, it just isn't the way common sense says that it works. And also, and a different idea, is that much more of the world operates in an uncertain way, in a statistical way, than we're aware of. And both those ideas become quite a surprise to people who are training to be physicists. And they continue to surprise and delight me as well. I was an astronomer once and thought of uncertainty in certain terms. But working at the ANU over the last couple of years, different kinds of uncertainties have impinged on me. There's the ones that have to do with being a Deputy Vice-Chancellor. You always wonder whether you're doing the right thing. And your colleagues are quite helpful to let you know that you're not. But there's also the other kind of uncertainty that you encounter. Being a Deputy Vice-Chancellor is wonderful because you meet so many scholars who are dealing with the unknown, the uncertainty, the riskiness of the community and the societies that we live in. And being a physicist, I relate that back to uncertainty and in the physics sense. And I was just going to sort of... you probably have seen, or some of you would have seen, the COMPASS program that's running at present with Dawkins beating up on people who believe in tarot and astrology and things like that. And I must say that while I don't necessarily agree, I have to say this very clearly, in tarot and astrology as predictive media, I certainly don't agree with Dawkins' quite narrow view about the role of rationality in the world, partly because I think I'm a physicist and he's a biologist, and partly because I think I'm the Deputy Vice-Chancellor and I really do know what uncertainty is about. So that's my little comment, but Michael Wesley has a lot more to say about risks, uncertainty and the future, and deals on a daily basis with some of the most important risks that we face in our lives, namely the risks that arise from the way that groups of people or nations interact with each other and have in their hands the tools that can bring about our mutual destruction. Michael is Professor of Industrial Relations and Director of the Griffith Asia Institute. He was actually recently on my television as I watched avidly the Rudd 2020 summit. Michael was one of the co-chairs of one of the panels, and he's also a program leader in the ARC Centre of Excellence that ANU and Griffith have in policing and security. Prior to taking up his position at Griffith University in 2004, he was the Assistant Director General for Transnational Studies at the Office of National Assessments. I think that makes him a spook. And before he joined the ONA He was a senior lecturer in the School of Politics and International Relations at University of New South Wales. He's written a number of books, Casualties of the New World Order, The Causes of Failure of UN Missions in Civil Wars, and most recently one that I am looking forward to reading, The Howard Paradox, Australian Diplomacy in Asia through the Howard Years. Michael's the editor of the Australian Journal of International Affairs, a member of the Australian Member Committee of the Council for Security Cooperation of the Asia Pacific, and a member of the National Executive of the Australian Institute for International Affairs. He's very well qualified to give tonight's ANU Toyota public lecture and book launch on the topic Risk, Uncertainty and the Future of National Security. Professor Michael Wesley.
Thank you, Lawrence, for that very generous introduction, and it is a delight to be here this evening. I spent last week at the beach, and I needed some time off, and when I was packing my bag, I packed two books. I packed this book, and I packed the latest novel in a Chinese detective series that I've been looking forward to reading for a very long time. And I thought to myself, sorry about this, Gabrielle and Mike, I will, I guess, wade through this book and I will reward myself with reading large swathes of the latest Chu Xiaolong detective thriller. I ended up reading this book cover to cover, and I think I've just about got through the first chapter of Chu Xiaolong's book, which is probably going to be a fantastic book. But that is my way of saying that completely unexpectedly, I found this book very, very hard to put down. And I'm not saying that because I've been paid a large amount of money or because I just want to be nice. It was genuinely interesting. Because what it did was it made me start to think about some of my own intellectual interests and preoccupations in a completely different way. Lawrence said that uncertainty and risk is something that he's thought about regularly from a number of different perspectives. I probably should be embarrassed to say that I actually haven't thought about uncertainty very much in my own professional career. And it's an academic career in international relations and security studies, and also a professional stint working for an intelligence agency. Yes, I guess in some senses I was a spook, Lawrence, though I was analysing intelligence rather than collecting it. And yes, I had never really thought about uncertainty, and it really made me start to think about some familiar things in totally different ways. And that's why I found the entire book so compelling. I suppose having made an introduction like that, I should start this presentation at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. I don't know how many people in this room have been to CIA headquarters, but it's quite an experience because it's a nice drive out from Washington along the banks of the Potomac River, and you come to the George H.W. Bush Center of Intelligence. They had to put the H.W. in there because it couldn't be the George W. Bush Center of Intelligence. And you go through the guard post with, you know, huge Marines and so on pointing guns in all directions, and you're taken into the main entrance hall of the CIA, the place where they receive people. And it's a big glittering foyer, and there is an inscription engraved into the wall in foot-high letters. And the inscription is a quotation from the Bible. From memory, it's John chapter 6, verse 24. "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." It's a fascinating calling card, a motto, if you like, that the CIA has established for itself, because it basically tells you what the CIA believes its mission is, how it relates to the rest of America and how it relates to national security. First of all, the CIA is telling you that it is the part of government that can deliver the truth. It can deliver the truth to policymakers. And beyond that, that the truth, remember when the inscription was put on the wall, deep in the Cold War, that the truth will enable America to fight for freedom around the world, that the truth is necessary to national security. And the inscription flashed back into my mind because, of course, this is also a statement about certainty, uncertainty, and risk. America faces a whole lot of risks about which it is uncertain, and therefore it creates an intelligence agency and a variety of other national security agencies to help it manage those risks. It all fits together really nicely. And of course, the conclusion is therefore obvious. The next step that occurred to me as I gazed out at the waves and so on, was that security and national security, in a sense, if you pair everything back, is about the manipulation of certainty and uncertainty. It's about how governments perceive certainty and uncertainty, and it's about the agencies that they set up to manipulate and to work with certainty and uncertainty. If you go to the psychological literature, you find studies that show with very early infants that the regulation of uncertainty is one of the earliest and most profound human motivations. Studies show that infants become, from the age of a couple of months, become deeply interested in contingent relations, contingency relations, in the confirmation or violation of expectations. And so many of the games we play with very young infants are around the themes of establishing contingency and certainty and tricking them with seeming uncertainty. When you think about it, certainty is a deeply enabling condition. When we are certain, we know what to do, we know what we want, and we know how to go and get it. On the other hand, uncertainty is profoundly disempowering. Uncertainty can lead to deception, deliberate deception by others. Uncertainty can lead to confusion, where we don't really know what we want and we don't really know how we can get there. If you expand the frame then to society and the state from the individual, you see that certainty and uncertainty are also basic to the operation of societies and to the viability of states. If you like to think about trust as one of the main things that holds a society such as ours together, that allows people to interact with a sense of safety, with a sense of certainty and surety, then you can think about that as horizontal trust, the trust that exists between citizens, the civility that makes a society work. And you can see that when societies begin to break down, they lose that sense of civility. They lose that sense of trust between people, the expectation of trust. That horizontal trust, if you like, depends on a prior vertical trust between citizens and their state. The trust that the citizens have that the state will enforce civility and will protect them from external attacks on their ways of being and their ways of life. So it's a rather old point that the trust that the state provides to its citizens enables the trust to develop between them. Because once that trust, that vertical trust, evaporates, citizens start to stop trusting each other and they start taking the enforcement and protection of themselves into their own hands, which leads directly to social breakdown. We've seen this this dynamic so often in our own region. And so I think basically certainty and uncertainty are so central to the way we think about the state and our own security, as well as what I would like to argue, international security. Now, as Mike Smithson puts it in his chapter in the book, uncertainty occurs naturally. Uncertainty is everywhere. It's a fact of life. As Lawrence said, you cannot live in perfect certainty. It is impossible. No one has the ability to comprehend everything and comprehend the truth about everything available. But Mike Smithson points out that significant uncertainty, the uncertainty that matters to human beings, whether individually or in groups, is socially constructed. That we have expectations of certainty which makes certain types of uncertainty unacceptable. That we expect to be certain about certain things, and if we're not, that sets up an expectation, a socially constructed expectation. And if we think about national security in this way, there is an expectation then among citizens, the citizens of a state, that the government can provide and achieve certainty about citizens' safety, their future, their integrity, and their welfare. These are things that we expect of our governments, and if we don't see our governments being able to provide some measure of certainty against these things, then of course we vote them out of office. So the government is expected to be able to eliminate sources of social uncertainty in relation to these values: safety, the future, integrity, welfare, and so on. And I would argue that the national security institutions of the state are at the very forefront of the government mechanisms for identifying and reducing threatening uncertainty about the outside world. What I'd like to suggest is that national security is basically a dynamic in which a state tries to establish the maximum possible certainty against adversaries for itself, while increasing the uncertainty of its adversaries. To go back to the psychological literature, there's an interesting concept in psychology that is called the locus of control. When someone is said to have an internal locus of control, they believe that they are very much in control of their own destiny, that they know what they want, and that they feel that they have the ability to go out and get what they want. When someone has an external locus of control, on the other hand, they feel that other people, other forces are controlling their life. That often they don't know what they want, and even when they do know what they want, they don't have the means. Other people, other forces control the means for what they want. So if we think about the state's security task in terms of a locus of control, the state, through its security institutions, tries to internalise as much as possible its own control over its own destiny, its own objectives, and its own ability to achieve those objectives. And I would argue that the essence of national security and international security is identifying and trying to externalise as much as possible the locus of control of adversaries and those who threaten us. Now, I would argue that the central question that confronts national security agencies, and this is a question that is posed in a chapter in this book, is how do our national security agencies understand the world, by which I mean how do they locate the certainties in the world, what they think they know about the world, and how do they perceive and order the uncertainties? I'm getting very close to Donald Rumsfeld here and known unknowns and unknown unknowns, but I think you know what I mean. And inherent in our ability to think about national security, inherent in our understanding of the usefulness of the state and its national security institutions, is our belief in their capacity to identify significant uncertainties and reduce those uncertainties while manipulating and externalising the uncertainties of those who threaten us and are our adversaries. It's therefore what I would argue here is that certainty and uncertainty are central to the national security task, which is basically a question of internalising and externalising locuses of control. The central question, however, that is posed by the chapter in this book is, does our national security agency's picture of the world, where certainties and uncertainties are located, correspond to how the world actually is? Does it correspond to how the world has evolved? Are we looking for certainties and uncertainties in a world that has moved on and become threatening in different ways? And that's what I'd like to talk a little bit about tonight. My basic argument is that the nature of the national security task is changing. It is locating certainties and uncertainties in different places. And most importantly, what this book helped me understand is that the nature of uncertainty differs, and the consequences of different types of uncertainty are different. And what we expect from our national security agencies, therefore, differs. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that. There are basically four questions that Michael Smithson poses in one of the opening chapters of the book. And I'm going to paraphrase here, Mike, because it kind of helps me understand. First question in thinking about uncertainty: what are the various types of uncertainty that are important to us in a national security sense? And he suggests that there are two basic types of uncertainty. One is distortion, and the other is incompleteness. I'll talk more about this in a few moments. Secondly, how are those uncertainties constituted or comprised? And he suggests four basic ways deriving out of the two basic types of uncertainty: inaccuracy, confusion, unawareness, and absence. Thirdly, what are the consequences of each type of uncertainty in national security terms? What will happen if we continue to be uncertain about these issues? Fourthly, what are our national security agencies expected to do about these uncertainties? What do we expect of them in relation to these? And Mike, I'm afraid I've added a fifth question, is how possible is certainty in relation... how possible is the achievement of certainty in relation to these uncertainties? What I'd like to suggest is that this helps us think about how security challenges have evolved. And I've got to be very careful because I see Doug Keane sitting in the audience, and who's a former colleague from ONA, and we often used to have debates about this. I would argue that security challenges are evolving from threats towards risks. By threats, I mean specific dangers that are measured on the basis of the capacity of an adversary to realise a hostile intent against us. By risks, I mean scenarios that are measured on the basis of the likelihood of an adverse occurrence happening. So how do these differ? Well, they differ across several variables. We counter threats in a very Clausewitzian way by seeking to affect the will and the capacity of our adversary to do something nasty to us. we counter risks by working either to preempt the scenario occurring or by building our own resilience against the consequences of the scenario. Against threats, our present actions are intended to produce future consequences. Conversely, with risks, anticipated consequences shape current actions. A good way to think about it is to think about global warming, to think about an intended consequence which we are using to shape our current actions. With threats, I would argue the national security focus is on our adversary's capacity and intent. When we think about risks in a national security context, we focus on the likelihood that a certain scenario will occur and the scale of damage that scenario will incur if it happens. I would argue that increasingly threats are being replaced by risks in developed democracies like Australia's national security priorities. And I think this has several causes and several... And I'd like to throw three of them out on the table. Firstly, if you look at the incidence of major wars between states, these are in precipitous decline. We haven't seen major wars between great powers and certainly significant states for a very long time. And arguably this will decline over time. Secondly, as we become more safe and more prosperous, an interesting psychological phenomenon kicks in. There's an element of economic theory called prospect theory. And one of the things that prospect theory suggests is that the more you have, the less you're willing to risk. That the less you have, the more you're willing to risk to improve your position. I would argue that as we become safer and as we become more prosperous, we also become more risk averse. We become highly sensitive to risks that we really wouldn't have cared about 50 years ago or 60 years ago. And finally, I would argue that globalisation makes us highly attentive to risks, because globalisation pits two logics against each other. On the one hand, globalisation depends on the trust I was talking about stability, about people being confident increasingly that they can rely on ordered processes and ordered understandings and expectations far beyond their borders, but also within their borders. So on the one hand, globalisation is a process that is deeply dependent on a stable order. And I would argue that that stable order exists in the world today. But globalisation at the same time is a deeply destabilising process and a deeply disordering process. It thrives, it makes its major gains, its major prosperity on disorder and using disorder. And I would call it basically a creative disorder that it does. But also this creative disorder does empower actors that are below the level of the state that have malevolent intent or that seek to make illicit gains from the processes of globalisation. Now, what I'd like to do for the rest of the time I'm going to talk to you is to examine the nature of uncertainty in relation to threats and in relation to risks. And I'm going to examine uncertainty in relation to threats against how we think about uncertainty in relation to capabilities of adversaries and intent of adversaries, and how we think about uncertainty in relation to risk in terms of the likelihood of nasty things happening and the scale of damage that those nasty things will occur. And what I'd like to throw out to you is that these different issues in national security thinking and uncertainty lie along a continuum. And it's a continuum, and I'm using an American academic, Greg Treverton's ideas here, that lies between, if you like, puzzles and mysteries. Okay, one end is puzzles, the other end is mysteries. What do I mean by that? Puzzles are basically things that we don't know, but the answer, to quote the X-Files, is out there somewhere. So, to use a national security example, how many missiles tipped with nuclear weapons does the People's Republic of China have? There are probably some people in this room who know the answer to that question. I don't know the answer to that question. It's an incompleteness in my knowledge, but I know that it is possible to know the answer to that. There is an actual answer to that question. And that if certain types of spooks, Lawrence, put sources in the right places and collect the right sort of information, we can eventually know the answer to that question. A mystery, on the other hand, is something that we don't know, but there is no definitive answer to that question. What's an example of that? Well, I would say an example of that is the answer to the question, where will be the next major terrorist attack against a developed democracy? Where and when will that occur? Now, even if the CIA does have Osama bin Laden in a cupboard somewhere, and even if Osama bin Laden still has control over the Al-Qaeda organisation, I would argue that even if they applied their interesting interrogation techniques to him and he told them what he thought was the right answer, I would argue that that is not necessarily the right answer. Why? Well, because a terrorist attack, particularly a major terrorist attack, depends on contingent factors. If the terrorists have everything ready and they turn up and something suddenly isn't right, security is tighter one day, or the plane has been cancelled or something like that, they simply walk away again and they do it the next week. Or if a terrorist suddenly sees a target of opportunity, they've been thinking about doing something and suddenly the security is not as tight one day, they will go home and they will carry it out that day. What I'm suggesting to you is that there is no way of knowing, because of the contingent nature of a terrorist attack, when and where the next one is going to occur. But what I would like to suggest is that citizens' national security expectations expect the same sorts of uncertainty against puzzles as they do against mysteries. And that's one of the things that particularly worries me. Our expectations of our national security agencies is that they will know when the next attack is going to occur and where, and that they will be able to prevent it. Okay, let's talk about capability. And a good way of thinking about this, so it doesn't get too esoteric, is how many usable nuclear weapons does North Korea have? Again, there are probably people in this room, Ron Huskin probably knows, who know the answer to that. I certainly don't know the answer, but I assume that there is an answer out there. What type of uncertainty is involved? And here I'm relying on Mike Smithson's typology. Well, I think the first type, the type of uncertainty is incompleteness. Our knowledge is incomplete. The knowledge is out there, but we simply don't know the full extent of what North Korea's nuclear program is. How is it constituted? How is the uncertainty constituted? Well, it's an absence of knowledge. There are facts out there that presumably we can go and get. What are the consequences of uncertainty in national security terms about North Korea's number of nuclear weapons? I would argue that they are the possibilities of miscalculation, that either we overestimate or we underestimate what North Korea's, how many nuclear weapons it has and whether it can use them. And therefore, we are acting in that sense of deep uncertainty where we're not sure about what to do. And to use the old locus of control argument, it gives North Korea an ability to externalise our own locus of control in relation to that actual occurrence. What are our expectations of our national security agencies? Well, simply that they eliminate the uncertainty. They go out and they find the information that will allow us to act with greater certainty. What is the possibility of finding certainty in relation to that information? Well, presuming it exists and presuming our national security agencies are good enough, the possibilities of attaining certainty are, I think, fairly good, fairly high, if we're able to get the right sort of people in the right sort of places. So that's capability. What about intent? The intention of an adversary, the intention of another state. And as an example of this, I would throw out the question to you, for what purpose is the People's Republic of China building influence in the South Pacific and Southeast Asia? Why is it doing this? What type of uncertainty is it? Well, again, it's an incompleteness in our knowledge. But it is constituted in a slightly different way, I think, from our non-knowledge of how many nuclear weapons North Korea has. Because we have some idea. We have some indications to go on. We can observe what the Chinese are doing partially. But we don't have certainty about the various theories, and there are debates going on about what China is doing. So I would say the constitution of uncertainty in relation to intent is opacity or indeterminacy. We have some idea, but we need to confirm some theories. We need to come down one way or the other. What are the consequences of uncertainty in national security terms? Well, they are deception, I would say. They allow the Chinese to build influence for reasons that we're not sure of. And therefore, we don't know whether we should see this as an entirely benign development or whether it's something that we should be deeply worried about and doing something about in terms of our own national security. What are the expectations of our intelligence agencies? I don't think we can actually expect that they eliminate uncertainty, because I think, you know, even within the Chinese government there are probably different views about why they're building so much influence in these regions close to Australia. But I think the expectation is that our national security agencies will reduce the uncertainty, will provide greater clarity, if not complete certainty. What is the possibility that we will find certainty? It's not high. I would say it's diffuse, that there are several sources that we can rely on to try and find certainty. Okay, let's move on to risk and the likelihood of nasty things occurring. And let's think about likelihood, and I think the best way of thinking about this is the debate on global warming. What is the likelihood that the rise in the Earth's temperatures will bring about not only adverse climate change effects and sea level rises and so on, but in relation to national security, what is the likelihood that these will have serious effects on our national security? That they will trigger resource wars, that they will trigger large-scale movements of people from populous countries to less populous countries? What is the type of uncertainty that we confront in relation to this? And I'm certainly looking forward to Mike's comments on my interpretations here. I think in relation to this, we face a form of distortion, that we have some expectations of the future that we project out, but we know that they're not going to be completely right. And so there is a form of distortion going on. How is the uncertainty constituted? As I would say, a form of confusion. That we are constantly driven to try and make sense of the future and think rigorously about the future, but we are confused. We don't have the information, the absolute certainty that we need to make important policy judgments about what we do. What are the consequences of uncertainty? The consequences of uncertainty are either underpreparedness or overpreparedness. We can take the threat not seriously enough, or we can take it so seriously that we overshoot the mark in what to do about it. What are our expectations in terms of our national security and our national security agencies? I understand that this is actually a big topic of debate and discussion within our national security agencies at the moment. I would argue that what we expect is that they provide us with greater understanding and that they provide us with the tools that enable us to put into practice the policies that will help us deal with this issue. What is the possibility of attaining certainty? Very low, I would argue. Finally, let's think about certainty and uncertainty in terms of the scale of disaster. And I'd urge you to think about terrorism in relation to this. Firstly, what is the type of uncertainty involved in trying to predict and think about where and when and how bad the next terrorist attack will be that involves Australia? I think the type of uncertainty, again, is distortion. And the reason is because there is this expectation that terrorists are adversaries in the same way that states are adversaries. Therefore, we should focus on their capacity and their intent, and therefore we should be able to deal with them in the same way that we would deal with state-based threats. But these are different threats. They do not have the same will that is able to be manipulated by us in that true Clausewitzian sense. They don't care about particular populations. They don't care about particular territories. They are profoundly anti-territorial in many ways. And so we can't threaten them in the way that they threaten us and affect their will in that way. What is the constitution of uncertainty? This is an interesting question. It's a question that I struggled with at ONA, because you're confronted with a vast amount of information about possible terrorist activity, but all of it, just about, is of very uncertain provenance. You have no idea how valuable a piece of intelligence is. And what's worse, you're terrified that you will pass over a piece of information that will prove afterwards to be significant in being able to predict a terrorist attack. Because, let's face it, we live in a blame culture. When something goes wrong, people naturally ask who was to blame. Was there anyone to blame? So each terrorist attack, rest assured, or each perceived national security failure will be followed up by a parliamentary inquiry or two. The consequences of uncertainty, of course, are unpreparedness or overpreparedness once again. How much do we invest in building our capacities and going out after these organisations? And how much do we change of our own values in the course of doing so? What are our expectations of our intelligence agencies and our national security agencies? I would argue that this is where we need the most work in terms of the shifting of the national security task. Because I think we, at the moment, expect a level of certainty that is not possible against these types of risks. And I think we need to adjust what we expect of our national security agencies. What we should be expecting of them in relation to these risks is not certainty, but rather quantification and communication of levels of certainty and uncertainty. In other words, we need to be more honest, more open with the public, between government and public, about how much security the government can provide against these types of risks. What is the possibility of uncertainty in relation to these types of security actors? I would say it's almost non-existent. So, as risks displace threats, as central to the nature of our national security tasks, the nature, the location and significance of uncertainties is shifting. As need to our expectations about the possibilities of certainty in relation to these national security tasks. There are also various shifts, as I've alluded to, in the continuum between having too little information and having too much information. Being able to depend on information being right, being accurate, towards not being able to rely on the information that we have to provide that sort of certainty. These are challenges confronting our national security agencies. They confront them internally, within agencies, between the national security agencies of state, and between them and the elected government of the day. They are challenges of interpretation about certainty and uncertainty and the possibilities thereof between the government and society. And they have changed the nature of the national or the security relationship between our state and the various adversaries it faces. This is an extraordinary book because it provides an enormous breadth of perspectives on certainty and uncertainty. There are, how many chapters? I should have researched this. There are 28 chapters in this book, which means they're fairly short, they're engagingly written, and they're about all sorts of things. I found myself, and I had to pinch myself as someone who walked out of his maths exam in grade 12 thinking, I will never do maths again in my life. Sitting there reading with fascination a chapter on statistics and uncertainty and getting a hell of a lot out of it. There's a chapter in here on jazz music and uncertainty, on painting and uncertainty, on history and uncertainty, and so on and so forth. It's a very, very broad collection indeed. I would argue that these are the sorts of books that are the most stimulating, the most creative, the most productive, because they force us to think in different ways. They don't force us to think in different ways, they tease us to think in different ways about things that we've been thinking about for a long time. And for that reason, this is a highly rewarding read. I urge you to go out and get yourself a copy of this book, because I can guarantee it will really shift the way that you think about the world. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Michael. It's my great pleasure now to invite Professor Alison Ritter to propose a vote of thanks. Alison's the head of the Drug Policy Modelling Program at Colonial Foundation Trust, which is a sponsor of the book. And on behalf of ANU, I'd like to thank the Colonial Trust for the help that they've given. Thanks very much, Alison.
I've got the good job of saying a few thank yous, which is my great pleasure. I am, as Lawrence has said, the director of the Drug Policy Modelling Program. It's a program of research and practice in relation to drug policy in Australia. We have a number of collaborators. I'm at the University of New South Wales. We collaborate with the ANU and with Griffith University and Macfarlane Burnet in Melbourne, and some international collaborations. We've been very generously funded by a philanthropy, Colonial Foundation Trust. They've funded us in the order of $10 million. And a part of that funding has enabled this book to happen. So I'm enormously personally appreciative to Colonial Foundation Trust. But also there are some other people to thank, aside from the people that had the money to put it up. The first person I'd like to thank, of course, is Professor Gabrielle Bammer, who is sitting down the front, and she's going to stand up and say hello. Gabrielle's been my mentor for over 10 years. She has developed and created integration and implementation sciences, and one part of integration and implementation sciences has been the examination of uncertainty. She's also the genius that brings together a jazz musician, myself, a clinical psychologist, an art historian, an intelligence analyst, a statistician and a philosopher and so on. And she was the one that decided that multidisciplinary perspectives on uncertainty were so important and brought us all together 2.5 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. And then, of course, brought in Michael Smithson, the other editor of the book. Please stand up, Michael, and take a bow. Who was our resident expert in the content domain of uncertainty. We had an absolute blast at Goola Brian. It was terrific, and it's fantastic to see some of my co-authors here tonight. We are all supposed to be wearing badges, so you can identify us and find out who the politician is and who the jazz musician is when we have drinks at the conclusion. Although, based on Michael's presentation, it actually might be more interesting to talk to the people who don't have badges. Sounds like we've got some interesting people here. And, of course, that leads me to thank Michael Wesley for a very stimulating presentation. This series is sponsored by Toyota. It's the ANU Public Lecture Series, and it's been a great honour to have Michael here. Delighted that you enjoyed the book so much, and your depth of experience in relation to intelligence and the nature of uncertainty in that context has really been quite thought-provoking. So please join with me in thanking Michael Wesley.